we will get started. So welcome everybody to the final Caston Centre public event of the year. I first must start off by acknowledging the traditional owners of the land upon which we meet, the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation. As those of you who come a lot will know, the Caston Centre traditionally does try to tweet its events, and so if you would like to join in on Twitter, the hashtag today, as is written on these yellow signs, is CC Liberty. And it gives me great pleasure to introduce our speaker tonight, which is Professor David Cole of the Georgetown University Law Centre, who is a volunteer attorney for the Centre for Constitutional Rights, also the legal affairs correspondent for The Nation, and a regular contributor to the New York Review of Books. He is the author of six books which have all won numerous, or which have won numerous prizes. He has also litigated in many significant constitutional cases in the US, including in the Supreme Court, particularly on the issue of free speech. For example, most recently he was involved in Holder and the Humanitarian Law Project, which challenged the constitutionality of a statute which prohibited, quote, material support to terrorists, and which makes speech which advocating peace and human rights a crime. David has been described by a New York Times columnist, Anthony Lewis, as one of the country's great legal voices for civil liberties today. He has received numerous awards for his human rights work, including from Society of American Law Teachers, the National Lawyers Guild, the ACLU of Southern California, the ABA Section on Individual Rights and Responsibilities, and the American Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee. David's presentation today is on Where Liberty Lies, Civil Society and Individual Rights in America's War on Terror After 9/11. Please welcome David Cole.
Thank you, Sarah, and thank you all for coming. What I'd like to do is sort of reflect on the first decade after 9/11 and lessons we might draw from that, not only about counterterrorism and human rights, but more generally about the project of constitutionalism and about what it requires to be meaningful. And I think I want to start by asking you to put yourself, you know, sort of back in time to September 11th, 2001. And imagine that somebody had come to you on that day as the Twin Towers had fallen, killing 3,000 people. Imagine that someone had come to you and said, you know, the United States is not going to be able to do whatever it wants in response to this attack. You might well have dismissed that person as living in some kind of airy-fairy human rights land and not realizing the reality of the thing, which was the United States was the most powerful nation in the world, that it had a military that was larger than the next 20 countries' militaries combined, that there was no competing superpower, that it had just been attacked in a horrific and vicious way by an entity that had few friends beyond the Taliban. And if you had looked at the history of American responses in times of national security crisis, you would have seen that historically, the American government, in particular the executive, had responded in ways that acted as though no one could stop them from doing whatever they wanted to do, and were, for the most part, generally right about that. So President Lincoln suspended habeas corpus during the Civil War. President Roosevelt locked up 120,000 Japanese Americans and Japanese citizens simply because of their ethnicity during World War II and the like, and no major opposition to those sorts of activities. And indeed, America did overreact and did act as if no one could stop it in doing whatever it deemed necessary to secure the nation from further attacks. And I think in some respects that's the least surprising thing about the post 9/11 era. The more surprising thing about the post 9/11 era, and what I want to focus on largely today, is the fact that the Bush administration was forced to curtail virtually all of its most aggressive measures over the course of its 8 years in office. And that when President Obama came to office, he came to office on a campaign that promised more curtailments and indeed delivered more curtailments of the Bush administration's most aggressive responses in the war on terror. And then I want to ask, well, what caused these curtailments? What led to these curtailments? And I want to argue that it was not the courts, it was not the Congress, and it was not the American people at large. The American people at large were big fans of President Bush and even reelected him in 2004. So where was the resistance coming from? And I'll suggest that it was coming largely from civil society, and particularly from institutions within civil society, including NGOs, which are nothing more than citizens who come together committed to a certain set of constitutional and or human rights. The media, which is committed to disclosure, transparency, and free expression, certain critical aspects of civil society. Individuals in the government who I think were, in many respects, affected by the values of civil society and spoke up and fought for reform within government, aided by the organizing outside of government, and foreign voices, and in particular foreign voices that were informed by many of the criticisms that human rights and civil liberty organizations had articulated and put out in reports and the like, and which then were brought back to bear on the Bush administration by European and other diplomats from our allies who were very concerned about the kinds of measures that we were engaging in, and concerned that their alliance with the United States in a variety of measures would be tarred by a sense of complicity with the kinds of actions that the Bush administration had taken. And then finally, I want to suggest that this account, if it's accurate, has implications for constitutional theory, has implications for constitutional law and doctrine, and has implications for constitutional practice. So first, just a brief review of the overreactions of the measures that President Bush put in place in the early going after 9/11, and many of these are very familiar, I'm sure, to you, although probably somewhat less familiar than to those of us who lived in the midst of them. Most infamously, President Bush authorized the CIA to engage in what he called enhanced interrogation tactics, what the rest of the world more accurately called torture. He authorized the CIA to engage in rendition to torture, where we forcibly abducted individuals and delivered them to countries like Syria, Jordan, Egypt, and particularly to their security services, who we knew and who, in fact, our State Department repeatedly criticized for engaging in widespread tactics of torture in interrogating folks, and we gave them questions that they then asked while subjecting the detainees to torture. President Bush held detainees at Guantanamo, initially in secret, wouldn't even disclose who was there or what, much less why they were there, refused to provide any hearings or process for them whatsoever, assured that they assured everyone they were the worst of the worst, and therefore there need be no process, argued that they were not entitled to the Geneva Convention protections, and they were then, like the CIA's detainees, subjected to abusive interrogation tactics, including torture. He created the secret prisons in Europe and elsewhere, run by the CIA, into which we disappeared suspects for years at a time. Disappearance is, of course, a tactic made famous by the Argentine military junta. We adopted it during the war on terror. President Bush unilaterally created a system of military commissions in which people could be tried and executed on the basis of evidence obtained via torture. There was no judicial review of the military commissions as originally set out. The president would authorize the prosecution, and the president would be the final stage of appeal before the individuals were executed. They took the position that the Convention Against Torture's prohibition on cruel, inhuman, and degrading treatment just doesn't apply to foreigners held outside of U.S. borders. Here's a human rights treaty that's designed to protect everybody, but they said, no, it doesn't protect foreigners held outside of our borders. They did that because, of course, if you did say the cruel, inhuman, and degrading treatment prohibition applied, it would raise very difficult problems for the CIA's enhanced interrogation tactics program. He took the position that the president, as commander-in-chief, had uncheckable power, that is, power to override acts of Congress and the courts in the context of engaging the enemy. His argument was a kind of a modern-day resurrection of an argument made by President Richard Nixon. Richard Nixon authorized warrantless wiretapping of Americans during the Vietnam War, and when he resigned and was being interviewed by David Frost, David Frost asked him, why did you think you could authorize warrantless wiretapping of Americans? Wiretapping generally requires a warrant under our Fourth Amendment. And President Nixon said, well, my understanding was if the president does it, that means it's not illegal. And that understanding of President Nixon learned the hard way, that is not the basic gist of our constitutional law. But President Bush essentially resurrected that and said if the president does it in the name of the commander-in-chief power, then it's not illegal. And on that theory, he authorized warrantless wiretapping by the National Security Agency in contravention of a criminal statute on point that said that warrantless wiretapping is a crime. And it's a crime during wartime, and if the president thinks he needs something extraordinary, he should come to Congress for authorization. He bypassed them altogether. So that's sort of the indictment, I guess, the cast of charges against the Bush administration. Very troubling, fairly familiar at this point. But I think, looking at it now 10 years back, what's more surprising, as I suggested, is that Bush curtailed these measures. So when the memo authorizing torture, written in secret, signed off on by, everybody in the cabinet, became public because the Washington Post, someone leaked it to the Washington Post, and the Washington Post published it on its website, the Bush administration immediately retracted that memo. They could not sustain in public, in the light of public eye, something that, every cabinet minister had signed off on in private. Renditions to torture essentially stopped in response, I think, to European allies and others' objections to that practice. President Bush eventually brought the detainees who had been disappeared in CIA black sites out of those black sites, brought them above ground, acknowledged their detention, and put them at Guantanamo Bay. He gave Guantanamo Bay detainees hearings without any court requiring him to do so, and indeed before the Supreme Court even ruled on any of the Guantanamo cases. He released 500 detainees from Guantanamo, not one of them ordered released by a court or by Congress. And he placed the NSA's warrantless wiretapping program under the aegis of a judicial warrant and oversight process. Then President Obama came into power, and he took things further. He closed the CIA's black sites, which were empty at the time, but were still open. He formally ended the CIA's enhanced interrogation tactics program. He released a whole slew of formerly secret torture memos that had been used to justify the CIA's enhanced interrogation tactics program, precisely so that it would never happen again. He promised to close Guantanamo within 1 year of his taking office. He hasn't succeeded in that, but largely because of domestic opposition from Congress. He refused to rely on President Bush's notion of inherent executive commander-in-chief power, and indeed, when the Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit, which is essentially the second highest court in the United States, ruled in a Guantanamo habeas case that the president is not bound by the laws of war in his detention of people at Guantanamo, President Obama filed a brief with the court saying, "You're wrong. You gave me too much power. I am constrained by the laws of war." A remarkable act of an executive branch official saying to the courts, "You've given me too much power. My power is more constrained than you say." And President Obama released another 100 or so Guantanamo detainees, at least until Congress tied his hands significantly in doing so. He also made a major speech on national security in May 2009 in which he sought to sort of articulate a vision that is in contradistinction to the Bush vision. The Bush vision was security overall. Rights are not relevant. They're obstacles to be thrust aside. We need to do what is necessary for the security of the nation. What President Obama said was, no, we are a country that is committed to the rule of law, committed to constitutional values, and we are stronger, not weaker, if we respond to the threat of terror within the frame of that set of principles. Now, President Obama has been far from perfect. He has relied on very broad state secrets privileges to bar lawsuits on behalf of people who were rendered and tortured at the hands of the CIA. He has defended a very, very broad interpretation of the material support law, which was involved in a case that I litigated in the Supreme Court, in which the court held, after the Obama administration urged it to, that advocating for peace and human rights can be made a crime if it is done in conjunction with or in support of a group that we have put on a list as a designated terrorist organization. In that case, the Obama administration argued that filing an amicus brief in the Supreme Court on behalf of a designated terrorist group was a crime punishable by 15 years in prison. He has most infamously expanded the secret drone targeted killing program and has not issued a public set of rules or standards by which that practice is employed. And he has declined to pursue accountability and actually obstructed attempts to pursue accountability for those who committed war crimes and crimes against humanity in the context of the war on terror. So President Obama is not perfect, but I think what you see if you look at this this sort of development is that the Bush 2 administration, the second Bush administration, was much more law-abiding than the Bush 1, the 2000 to 2004 administration, and that the Obama administration has been still more law-abiding. What you also see is that we are no less safe as a result of those efforts to bring our security measures within the frame of the rule of law, and that there's never been any evidence that any of the lawless measures that President Bush took actually made us safer. None of the CIA's interrogation tactics led to the defusing of a ticking time bomb, for example, and the CIA's own inspector general who investigated the enhanced interrogation program found no evidence that any evidence obtained from enhanced interrogation could not have been obtained through more lawful measures. Meanwhile, the costs of these lawless measures are profound. Well, we, to this day, have still not brought any of the 9/11 conspirators to justice, not because we don't have them, we have them, but because of the way we treated them when we captured them, subjecting them to cruel, inhuman, degrading, and torturous tactics that make it very complicated to prosecute them. So they are now to be prosecuted in a military commission in Guantanamo, and we have done a couple of things to try to deal with this problem that, you know, it's embarrassing to prosecute them because of the way we treated them, and that might come up in trial. Well, first thing we've done is we've classified their own accounts of how they were treated. We have treated their accounts of how they were treated as state secrets, which means that nobody can articulate those secrets. Their lawyers can't articulate those secrets. The detainees themselves can't articulate those secrets. And so they had to build a special courtroom at Guantanamo for these trials where the well of the court, where the lawyers and the detainees and the judges will be sitting, is set off from the spectator area by a 1 foot thick plexiglass wall that is soundproof. And the purpose, and it goes floor to ceiling, and the purpose for that is not security, right? It's not, these people, you know, they have been, incapacitated. They don't pose a threat to security. The reason for that is because they then can have a tape delay, 40-second tape delay on what's going on in the courtroom, so that if any detainee happens to start talking about what the CIA did to him, we just shut off the time. We shut off the sound. A remarkable way to proceed, made necessary in the eyes of the United States by these tactics, which, of course, had the effect of squandering the world's sympathy. We had the world's sympathy on 9/11. Within 4 years, levels of anti-Americanism around the world had reached all-time highs in terms of polls. And, of course, at the same time as we squandered that sympathy, we also gave al-Qaeda the best recruitment propaganda it could possibly have. What caused this development over time, this return to a more law-abiding, more human rights respecting approach to the war on terror, or to the conflict with al-Qaeda more accurately? Well, you know, in constitutional theory generally, in the United States anyway, we think of constitutional law as operating principally through the courts. You know, when I teach constitutional law, what I teach are judicial decisions in which courts have addressed constitutional questions and declared acts of Congress or the President unconstitutional or not, as the case may be. That is what constitutional law is, what the courts do. To a lesser extent, a much lesser extent, we also teach about the separation of powers and the ways in which the branches check each other. The Congress checks the President. The President has powers to check Congress and the like. And generally speaking, in ordinary times, that's how constitutional law is understood to work, through these formal mechanisms of government. But in times of crisis, those systems don't tend to work. In World War I, Congress made it a crime to speak out against the war. The president prosecuted hundreds of people for doing nothing more than speaking out against the war, and the Supreme Court affirmed the convictions. So all three systems of government were in line in favor of security and against liberty. In World War II, the same thing with the Japanese internment. The Japanese internment advanced by President Roosevelt, not opposed by Congress, and affirmed by the United States Supreme Court. All three branches in lockstep. In the McCarthy period, the height of anti-communism, Congress passed very broad anti-communist laws that made it a crime to articulate communist ideas, to join the Communist Party. The president instituted, President Truman instituted a vast executive loyalty program where every government employee and every employee of every entity that did business with the government had to be investigated for their loyalty, whether they, you know, had friends who were communists or subscribed to magazines that were deemed communist. And the like, and the Supreme Court affirmed or stayed out of those actions until McCarthyism was on the wane, and Senator Joe McCarthy had been censored by the Senate. And only then did the court come in and say, wait a minute, you've gone too far, and to introduce some fairly significant restrictions. This time, in this crisis, Congress was, as it generally is, very deferential in matters of security. It enacted the USA Patriot Act very shortly after 9/11, giving the president expanded powers. It overturned, there were four Supreme Court decisions that went against President Bush. Two of them were on statutory grounds, and Congress responded to both by overturning them, by passing statutes that gave the president the power that the Supreme Court said it did not have. So Congress was not a major player. One exception, Senator John McCain, who himself was tortured in the Vietnam War, or the Korean War, I'm not sure, he sponsored a successful effort in Congress to overturn the Bush administration's theory that the cruel, inhuman, and degrading treatment protection didn't apply to foreigners. He got them to say it applies to everybody that the United States holds, regardless of what passport they have. But that's the only instance of Congress stepping up to the plate. The courts were less deferential. The Supreme Court was less deferential than in prior times. It rejected several of President Bush's key contentions and arguments that there's no judicial review at Guantanamo for detainees, that the Geneva Conventions don't apply to al-Qaeda, that the president has independent, uncheckable executive power to create military commissions, and that there need be no hearings whatsoever for U.S. citizens held as enemy combatants. The court rejected all of those positions, but at the same time, the court's rulings were actually quite limited. So in the two Guantanamo habeas cases, the only question was whether the detainees could get into court. That's all. Just, is the door open? And the court said, yes, it's open, initially on statutory grounds. And then Congress closed the door, and then the Supreme Court said it's open on constitutional grounds, meaning Congress can't close the door. But it said nothing about the rights the detainees might actually have, if any, once they got into court. In the Hamdan case, which involved the legitimacy of the military commissions, the court invalidated President Bush's military commissions, but its holding was predicated only on statutory grounds. And it said explicitly, Congress, if you want to give the president the power to do this, you know, you have the power to do that. And indeed, within 6 months, Congress had done precisely that. What the court actually required of the president was fairly limited. So I don't think you can account for most of the changes that I talked about by looking at the formal operation of separation of powers and judicial review. Torture, no court ordered that torture be ended. Torture has ended. No court ordered the halting of rendition to torture. That practice has ended. No court ordered the closing of the CIA's black sites and the end of disappearances. That practice has concluded. No court ordered the halting of the NSA's warrantless wiretapping surveillance program, and yet that program was stopped and put under the oversight of the courts. No court ordered that there must be hearings at Guantanamo, and yet they were provided. As I've said, over 600 people between Bush and Obama, over 600 people have been released from Guantanamo, not one by virtue of an unappealable court order. And no court held that President Bush's inherent, uncheckable executive power argument was untenable, and yet it has been abandoned. So you have to ask them, well, what caused this? And I don't think it was the courts. I don't think it was Congress. And as I said before, I don't think it was the American people. The American people, by and large, were not that unhappy with what was going on. And so if you look, where did the resistance come from? It came, I think, principally from civil society institutions. As I said before, groups that come together because of their commitment to certain kinds of rights and liberties. So the ACLU, you know, people talk about the living constitution. The living constitution is a metaphor, right? It's not true. It's not actually living, right? But the ACLU is a living embodiment of commitment to the Bill of Rights. The people who support the ACLU, who work for the ACLU, who are card-carrying members of the ACLU, they are living embodiments to this set of commitments. Same thing for the Center for Constitutional Rights, Human Rights Watch, Human Rights First, the Arab and Muslim civil rights organizations, the privacy rights organizations. There's quite a robust civil society set of institutions in the United States. And what's interesting is that they were some of the only people speaking out when President Bush was adopting these measures. And they actually did well by speaking out. That is, they increased their status. They increased their wealth. They increased their power. The ACLU tripled its budget, thanks to George Bush, and doubled its membership. The Center for Constitutional Rights doubled or tripled its budget. Many of these organizations really attained a lot of popular support. Again, not broad popular support, but deep popular support from those who are committed to these rights. And they issued reports. They filed lawsuits that then became the focal point of national and international attention on issues that otherwise would have been ignored, like Guantanamo and some of the rendition and detention practices. They worked with the media to disclose wrongdoing. They lobbied foreign governments and urged those foreign governments and diplomats to bring pressure to bear on the United States, which, as I said, I think was a very significant factor here. They organized, the Human Rights First, for example, organized a group of about 15 former four-star generals from the U.S. military to come together to speak out against these practices, to give it a kind of legitimacy from the standpoint of the military. And they organized protests, demonstrations, and the like, and they were a force, a place for resistance. The media was also, as I said, a place for resistance, largely by virtue of its disclosure of secret practices that could not withstand public scrutiny and could only continue as long as they avoided and evaded public scrutiny. But they also, some aspects of the media, in particular the New York Times and to some extent the Washington Post, were very insistent on editorializing against these programs. There were And then, as I said, many of the efforts to educate were not limited to the United States, but went outside the United States. And that was a very, I think, conscious move, because if you, reflect upon what we were doing in the wake of 9/11, almost all of it was being done not to us, but to them. Not to U.S. citizens, but to foreign nationals, and particularly to Arab and Muslim foreign nationals. And time and again, the administration would defend its actions by saying, it's not your rights we're taking away, the American people, it's their rights. And the American people, for the most part, that sounds like a pretty good deal to them. But if you're taking away, a Jordanian's rights, or you're taking away a Brit's rights, or you're taking away an Australian's rights, or a Canadian's rights, Canada, Australia, Britain, Jordan, they actually are going to be very interested in this. They're going to be very concerned about this. And so one of my clients, Maher Arar, exemplifies this. He's a Canadian who was coming back to Canada from a trip abroad when he was stopped at the while changing planes at JFK, and ultimately rendered to Syria, where he was tortured and spent a year in a cell the size of a grave, 6 feet by 3 feet by 5 feet. And when Maher Arar was eventually returned to the United States by Syria, to Canada by Syria, the Canadians had been very concerned about this case, and they put pressure on the government, and the government created an official inquiry, which wrote an 1,100-page report, which fully exonerated Mr. Arar. The Canadian Parliament unanimously apologized to Mr. Arar. Mr. Arar was paid $10 million in damages from the Canadian government. When I learned that, I emailed my co-counsel, who works at a private firm in New York, and his response was, is that $10 million Canadian or U.S.? To me, it was a lot either way, but I guess if you work at one of these New York firms, these things are relevant. So, whereas in the United States, most people haven't heard of of Maher Arar. And he's gotten no hearing, no inquiry, no apologies. When we brought a lawsuit to seek accountability, the Bush administration and then the Obama administration argued that the case should be dismissed because it touched on national security concerns. So, Maher Arar, 1 year, Time Canada named Maher Arar their person of the year. That same year, Time USA named George Bush their person of the year. So, these concerns played much more strongly outside the country than inside the country, but then that caused those countries in which those concerns were articulated to bring them back to bear on the United States. And that, I'm told by many former Bush officials who I've interviewed for a project I'm working on, that those concerns were were heard within the administration, because it made it harder to do anything with these countries to be seen as complicit with the United States, unless the United States sort of cleaned up its act. So I want to close just by suggesting three implications that this story has for constitutional theory, for constitutional law, and for constitutional practice. The first one for constitutional theory is that we need to pay more attention in constitutional theory to the work of civil society institutions. When we teach constitutional law, we look at the courts. We look a little bit at the President and Congress. We don't look at the work of these institutions, which I think play an important mediating role in doing the work of constitutionalism. And it's not only in times of crisis, but in other times as well that they do so. If it weren't for the gay rights groups, the right to marry of same-sex couples would still be unthinkable in the United States. Instead, it has succeeded to the point where it is very likely to be recognized in every state in the Union in the next 15 years. That's through the work of civil society organizations. And there are many, many similar examples. So The first is that constitutional theory needs to focus more on the role of these institutions and the implications of their role for constitutionalism on the ground. The second implication is for constitutional law. And I think if, in fact, it is critical to a meaningful constitutional framework that there be a robust civil society, then we should ensure, then it makes it all the more important that the constitutional law that creates the space for that civil society be jealously guarded. And in particular, the First Amendment right to speak and the First Amendment right to associate. That's what creates the space for civil society to operate within a frame that allows them to advocate vigorously against the government on these issues and in these times. And then finally, an implication for constitutional practice, and that is that if you are concerned about constitutional rights, human rights, and the like, you have to get engaged. You have to live an engaged life. Because that is engage with these issues through these organizations, because that's the lifeblood of constitutionalism. You can't sit back and read your newspaper and write your articles if you're a law professor and be skeptically disengaged if you care about these constitutional commitments. And so let me close with two quotes. The first is from one of the great judges of the United States, and he was not a Supreme Court judge, he was just a federal court judge, but he is widely understood to be one of the great judges. He certainly has the best name of any U.S. judge. His name was Learned Hand. And Learned Hand once wrote, "Liberty lies in the," and this is where the title of my talk today comes, "Liberty lies in the hearts of men and women. When it dies there, no constitution, no law, no court can even do much to help it. While it lies there, it needs no constitution, no law, no court to save it." Now, like all great quotes, this one overstates the case. The Constitution and courts, I think, play a critical role in maintaining the culture of rights, the resilience of the rule of law. But they can't do it alone. And as the period after 9/11 suggests, sometimes when they're not willing to do it, it is, in fact, liberty lying in the hearts and minds of people that makes the difference. And then a quote from two more recent commentators, Cornel West and Roberto Unger, professors at Princeton and Harvard, respectively. This is a quote on what makes people fight for justice. And they write, "Hope is more the consequence of action than its cause. As the experience of the spectator favors fatalism, so the experience of the agent produces hope." And I think what they mean by that is that people don't get engaged in struggle because they have hope. It's the other way around. People gain hope by engagement. And so the future, I think, of constitutionalism in the United States and of human rights around the world turns on the engagement of people through these institutions that in the long run give us hope. Thank you very much.